This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations.
This episode of Groundwire is produced by CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia.
My name is Alice Tennant.
And I'm Sam Moore, and we will be your hosts.
In this episode, an occupation of the Indigenous and Northern Affairs Office in Toronto, in solidarity with Attawapiskat Youth, and the protests against a Winnipeg DJ for racist videos. But first, here are the headlines.
On April 19th, Manitoba's reigning New Democratic Party went down to a stunning defeat at the hands of the opposition Progressive Conservatives. By the time ballots were counted, the PC leader and former Harper cabinet minister Brian Pallister secured 40 seats and 53% of the popular vote. The NDP, having been in power for almost two straight decades, collapsed to 14 seats, almost all in the city of Winnipeg. The Liberals were able to gain two extra seats in addition to the one they already held. The NDP had suffered a tremendous drop in popularity after leader Greg Selinger broke a promise and increased the provincial sales tax by one percentage point without calling a referendum. The NDP's popularity has also been hobbled by tragic reports springing from a child welfare system in some disarray. The Conservatives are back in power for the first time in nearly two decades, with a past track record of instigating unrest with labor and cutbacks to health care and education in the 1990s, politically progressive groups and individuals have some apprehensions about the return of the Conservatives to power.
I'm Josh Brandon, chair of Make Poverty History Manitoba. We do know that there's a lot of money to be saved by poverty reduction in the long term, but in the short term, there's going to be some investments that need to be made, improving our education system, improving our healthcare system, improving resources for low-income people to access housing and income supports. In order to do that, we can't cut taxes as much as Brian Pallister's promised during the election campaign. So raising the basic exemption, cutting the PST, these kinds of tax cuts will reduce our room for maneuvering for investing in the kinds of programs we need to end poverty in Manitoba.
I'm Gail Whalen-Enns. I'm the director of Manitoba Wildlands for Manitoba. I'm also on the National Board of Climate Action Network Canada and have represented the World Wildlife Fund in our province. They have had nothing to say about pipelines. There's a lot of paper that has to be pushed, a lot of permits, leases, permissions, energy agreements, and so on that are involved in these pipeline decisions in terms of Manitoba. And, for instance, on Energy East, there's potentially a great deal of revenue on an annual basis for Manitoba Hydro should Energy East go ahead. Lots of provincial responsibility can't be ignored, would be the comment. The caution for the new government is you can't really cut water stewardship and conservation. You should actually be building them up and returning them to the quality of service and knowledge that we need both for our environment and for our economy in Manitoba. So I hope they realize there's some departments that have just been cut too much.
The Conservatives' return to power could ironically mark an organizing opportunity as various factions of the left, those aligned with and those critical of the NDP, may be able to come together to unite in common cause.
On April the 13th, the Coroner for Central Region, Toronto East Office, announced they would be conducting an inquest into the death of Andrew Luku. Luku, a South Sudanese refugee and father of five, was living in Toronto. He was gunned down and killed by Toronto police last summer in his apartment building. Last month, the Special Investigation Unit announced it would not charge the officer responsible for Luku's murder, sparking the Black Lives Matter tent city protests outside police headquarters in Toronto. It lasted 2 weeks. One of the demands of the tent city was an investigation into the death of Luku, in addition to the rehauling of the Special Investigation Unit and releasing the name of the officer who shot Luku. Rodney DeBellis, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto, said that the coroner's announcement was a step forward in the right direction.
British Columbia has declared a public health emergency in response to increasing numbers of fentanyl overdoses. Provincial Health Officer Dr. Perry Kendall cited more than 200 overdose deaths in BC during the first 3 months of 2016. The declaration is usually reserved for contagious diseases outbreaks, but fentanyl was found in more than a third of people who died from overdose in the past year. Dr. Shona Nolan, a clinical assistant professor at the University of British Columbia, addictions physician at St. Paul's Hospital, and research scientist at the BC Center for HIV/AIDS, has applauded the province's decision.
It's a step made by the provincial government that has really started to address and recognize the extent of the underlying problem. And fentanyl is just one small piece of a larger problem, with the larger problem being opiate addiction in general in this province.
The declaration means that information will be gathered more quickly on all incidents of drug overdoses in order to warn users and provide help. Dr. Nolan says this is just one of many steps that can address the issue of opioid addiction and overdose in Canada. She says the first step is the education of drug users and healthcare practitioners.
A proportion of certainly the patients that I see who are currently using fentanyl or heroin or illicit prescription pills, their addiction originated after receiving a prescription from a physician or other healthcare provider. And so ensuring that physicians are prescribing opiates in an evidence-based fashion and putting the onus on the physician to ensure that their prescribing practices are in line with evidence-based practices is number one.
Dr. Nolan and other addiction specialists have also pointed to greater access to opiate substitutions like Suboxone, as well as evidence-based harm reduction strategies, including supervised injection sites.
Last week, UBC alumni Glynis Kirkmeyer held a workshop titled Graduate Students Respond to Sexual Assault at UBC. Discussion from the workshop is intended to inform her human rights complaint against the university.
And this is one of my many attempts to do outreach. So we got a small group of grad students together, and they had a discussion about what's there, what we expect from the university, and the plan moving forward. How can this be a community that is safe?
Kirkmeyer filed her complaint with the BC Human Rights Tribunal on March 21st in response to UBC's mishandling of sexual assault and harassment cases. These are the same cases featured in CBC's The Fifth Estate's documentary School of Secrets. Kirkmeyer argues not only was her case mishandled, but there is an ongoing systemic problem in how the university handles these types of cases. She hopes that her complaint will affect positive change at UBC. The complaint also included a vision statement that proposed changes to UBC's process. These include detailed improvements in policy, an independent advocacy centre, standards for the fact-finding process, process evaluation and training.
Part of the reason why I'm stating it in terms of a vision is that this is a demand that's so ambitious that I don't think that one lawsuit is going to do it, but I think that there's actually quite a will and a hunger within UBC to make changes like this happen and to not allow behind-the-scenes administrators or lawyers make the decisions that end up hurting members of the community. I feel hopeful about the ability of the UBC community to demand these things from the administrators.
UBC has currently received the complaint. They are also working on a standalone sexual assault policy, expected to be released in October.
That's it for the headlines.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
On Wednesday, April 13th, Indigenous activists and allies began an occupation of the Indigenous and Northern Affairs Office in Toronto in solidarity with Attawapiskat youth. Attawapiskat is a remote James Bay Cree community that recently called a state of emergency in response to 11 attempted suicides by youth on April 11th. The intentions of the occupation were to put additional pressure on the federal and Ontario provincial governments to meet the demands of the Attawapiskat youth. Additionally, protesters occupied the Vancouver and Winnipeg INAC offices and demonstrated outside them in Regina and Gatineau. The occupation came to an end in Toronto on April 21st, under the direction of Attawapiskat youth, while protesters continue to occupy the INAC offices in Winnipeg and Vancouver. The following speakers were recorded at a rally outside the Toronto Indigenous and Northern Affairs office on April 14th by Groundwire's Ome Salma Rahimtula.
So I would just like to say that this idea to take over INAC, it was started with an idea. I was listening to 680 News, and this emotion took over me, and I just decided, you know what, enough is enough of another crisis in Canada where First Nations people are once again not being listened to by the government. So what happened was I sent a text message out to a few people that I know. Some of them are upstairs. And I just want to thank you all for coming out here, natives and non-natives, because it's about time that the prophecy, the seventh generation prophecy, happens. So what that is all of the nations, the black, the white, the red, and the yellow, coming together. And there's no way that anybody can stop this from happening because of the fact that this was already foretold by our ancestors, like many, 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 many moons ago.
We also want to remind folks and continue to remind ourselves that this is about Attawapiskat and other communities that have been affected by many, many years and many crises, and that we need to remember to keep listening to the communities and what they need as those needs change. And that's what we're trying to do upstairs. It's been difficult to keep in contact with Attawapiskat because they're a flying community, but we have been intermittently. We are also in contact with Winnipeg, who has also taken over their INAC office. There was $2 million, I believe, allocated from the Ministry of Health, and we were really excited about that until we found out that it was just going to go, not just, it was going to go to social workers that were outside of the community to be supporting them in there. One of the issues with that is they may not have the understanding of the needs there, and there was quite a long list of demands that was looked for by the youth, and it was specifically said that it was not going to go towards the youth center, which is something that we really were looking for. So shame.
Shame!
Bringing it back to some of the things that the youth put in their list of needs in the men, we would like to say that I think that it's pretty devastating that we have to advocate for such minimal resources like a northern store. It really breaks my heart. It really breaks my heart to know that we have to advocate to get foods that are severely inflated price in the far north. And even things such as dust control. You know, these dirt roads, the fact that it's actually bringing into the airstream so much that they really want that dust control, that makes me sad. You know, it makes me sad that these lists of demands, that they're not even being really that acknowledged. And it's actually Trudeau went, after he went to a book launch in London, Ontario, somewhere in southern Ontario, he chose to go there before he went up to Attawapiskat.
Shame!
Shame! Shame!
I would like to say, in terms of Attawapiskat, media is constantly trying to turn it around on us. Where is that money going? Where did that, what was it? Oh, $35 million go 4 years ago. No, these are long-standing problems put onto us by the Indian Act and by the reserve system. And the fact that we only got that much money to deal with a long-standing, 500-year-long system is ridiculous. That onus should not be put on our First Nations and our young people who are dying. That onus needs to be put on the Canadian government, and that's where the responsibility lies. Not on our young people who are dying.
On this land, there's no way that we're all free and us black and indigenous people are free. It has to happen. Our freedom is symbiotic, it's connected. The ways in which oppression function on this land is through the stolen, ongoing, illegal occupation of this land and the slavery of black people. This is who created this land and this is whose bodies are at expense. So we have to stand in solidarity, we have to stand in support. The entire time at Tent City, the Indigenous community was with there holding us, loving us, protecting us.
A January 2015 Maclean's article by author Nancy MacDonald branded Winnipeg as, quote, arguably becoming Canada's most racist city. Community members have been working hard to overcome the perception and, more importantly, the realities behind that headline. But a couple of notorious videos attributed to a prominent and popular radio DJ surfaced in early April. It so outraged community members for its reinforcement of racist and other stereotypes that it triggered an afternoon protest at the DJ's workplace. Winnipeg Community Radio Station, CKUW, covered the story and provides the following report.
On April 12, 2016, about 1 p.m., I, Julian Cooper, went as media to a protest with what is estimated to be about 60 to 100 people inside and outside the building at 92 City FM at 166 Osborne Street in Winnipeg. Dave Wheeler, a popular radio host who hosts the show Wheeler in the Morning at 92 City FM, has caused a firestorm on social media and at the station over songs and videos he produced, which are deemed sexist, racist, and classist by those protesting. The songs were actually about 2 years old and were paired with videos. They are titled Transcona Girls and North End Boy. In this recording, you will hear Leslie Spillett. She is executive director of Gani Ganichik.
This kind of behavior in anywhere it exists, in this place or anywhere, is unacceptable. The important thing is that you're here to hold up another way of thinking, really, and doing. And we know that Canada, the Canada that we live in, is founded on racism. It's founded in patriarchy. It's founded in colonialism, pandemic. All of those things, all of those systems of oppression, it infects all of us because it dehumanizes us in such a fundamental way. And, you know, I know I'm sick of apologies. I want some to do something. Yeah. And I want to say I don't hate white people. I don't hate Christian people. I hate racism. I hate...
In this excerpt from Transcona Girls, here is a great example of classism within the lyrics.
They don't care, and the North End daughters really like to stab you and steal your bike. And the Wolseley girls with their hairy pits, they keep their girlfriends warm.
Here are some sound bites from the interviews.
Peyton Veach. I came here today because, like many other Winnipeggers, I was outraged. I think that after seeing the kind of misogyny, the kind of racism, the kind of classism in the videos that had Dave Wheeler's name attached to them, my response was very similar to the response of many others, and that is, we can't sit idly by and let this happen. We need to hold him accountable, we need to hold 92 City FM accountable, we need to hold Rogers, the parent company, accountable. This kind of hatred is not acceptable in our community, and I came here today to help amplify that message.
Jace Kettner. Well, there's a lot of reasons I'm here, based on, you know, how many groups City FM managed to attack and offend. With these songs and videos they release. So there's a lot of reasons I'm here.
Andrew Weinberg, University of Winnipeg student. We're here to raise attention to the unacceptability of the behavior and comments of Dave Wheeler and his radio program, and the unacceptability of City TV allowing this behavior to occur. And to demand that that Wheeler and the radio station City FM be held accountable, that that Dave Wheeler is terminated, and that the radio station apologizes to the people of Winnipeg and the North End and Winnipeg's inner city.
Dave Wheeler has in fact returned this week to Wheeler in the Morning at 92 City FM. After being suspended for only 1 week. We have an update from Leah Gazan, who is a professor at the University of Winnipeg, who also attended the event. Here is what she has to say.
The city signed an accord with all the different municipalities around the country where they committed to taking major steps in ending racism within city limits. Dave Wheeler, infringed on that. If they're serious about not supporting hate, then they really had no choice but to fire Dave Wheeler, and I really don't know where they are at on this anymore.
In Winnipeg, from Treaty 1 territory, in the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Julian Cooper for Groundwire.
That's it for our feature stories.
Now it's time for our community radio report.
Madeline Taylor is the spoken word coordinator at Vancouver Community Radio Station, CITR. She has been in the position for almost 1 year, and in that time, she has helped launch 3 new collective shows, including Lady Radio by the Women's Collective, Unceded Airways from the Indigenous Collective, and All Access Pass, hosted by the Accessibility Collective. Madeline has also assisted in the production of several radio documentaries that have been made for UBC's centennial anniversary. Rohit Joseph spoke with Madeline about what it's like to be a spoken word coordinator and the progress that has been made in talk programming at CITR.
Hi, I'm Madeline Taylor. I'm the spoken word coordinator at CITR 101.9 FM.
What drew you to this position?
Well, I love making spoken word radio. That's what I'd been doing at CJSF. So I was drawn to the opportunity to learn about a new space and to meet a bunch of new people who were interested in the same things that I was interested in. I was drawn to the chance to expand my own skill set and learn a lot more about like what structurally goes into making talk radio. I was also excited to share and give other people the opportunity to learn as much as I had learned in such a short period of time getting into making talk radio, because the learning curve's insane. Like, once you start doing it, you can become good at it very fast because it's such an accessible medium. So I just wanted to give more people the opportunities that I'd had and be there to, like, help develop people in a way that had benefited me so much.
So this was actually, from my knowledge at least, a new position for CITR Radio. What were some of the challenges you faced just trying to get things started as a spoken word coordinator?
Well, something that's always a challenge is just starting to learn who everybody is, because when you're walking into an organization that's as established as CITR, everybody knows everybody, and it's really easy to not be overlooked, but to not have people necessarily look to you right away as a resource because they're so used to finding answers in other places. So I think initially what was hard was trying to let people know that I was here at all and that I would be useful to them, and trying to figure out how I could be useful to people was really hard, and something I think I'm still figuring out. Also, I was writing my own rules in terms of workflow and finding resources and that sort of thing, because one thing about not-for-profits is that trying to keep institutional knowledge available and accessible from position to position and person to person as there's turnover is really challenging. So there isn't like a rule book or any kind of a user guide for becoming a spoken word coordinator.
So since you've taken over, there's been 3 new collective programs that have been introduced to CITR. What's been that experience of getting these new programs on the air and programs that have never really been done before at the station?
Yeah, it's been really fantastic. I think it's changed the face of the station a bit. It's meant that there are tons and tons of people who we wouldn't necessarily have connected with had it not been for those coordinators bringing in their personal communities and doing their own outreach. And it's helped create a structure that's going to be really sustainable and useful for CITR going forward, trying to stay and improve as an open space for media production from tons and tons of different communities.
What's been the thing that you've been most proud of in your 1 year as a spoken word coordinator?
Really the biggest accomplishment for me is like watching other people succeed. I feel like that's what's compelling about this job, is that you get to watch people develop and help people develop their skills in a way that that you don't in a lot of other organizations, because without the volunteers and without the people who come in and care about CITR and wanna make media, like, we don't exist. There's no point to my job if there aren't people who we can help develop. It's not so much like personal accomplishment for me. It's more just like contributing to this community. So that's where the success is.
That's all the questions I have for you, Madeline. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Just that I'm really glad CITR is investing in this area of radio, and that I think it's really important going forward. And I think it's really cool that the not-for-profit sector is sort of filling some of the vacuum that's been left with CBC cuts, mm-hmm. And trying to work towards becoming more of a resource for, you know, the sort of podcast revolution that's happening right now and riding some of that excitement. So hopefully we can keep doing that for people who don't want to pay tons of money to go learn how to make radio somewhere else. It's pretty cool to be able to offer it basically for free.
Thank you so much, Madeline. Yeah,
thanks.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on unceded Musqueam territory by CITR 101.9 FM at the University of British Columbia. Headlines this week were written by Ome Salma Rahimtula, Michael Welch, and Emily Blake.
We also thank Carly Forbes and Rohit Joseph. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.